So at this point, what you should be seeing behind me is a screen that says we're back in the Wise Words from a Friend series. We took a hiatus last week because in the fifth Sundays of 2019, we're going to be talking about Tangled Up in Grace. But we're back in it now, Wise Words from a Friend, and we are going to be talking today about fear, about how we can conquer fear through friendship. And what I'm realizing now is that I actually... It's perfect that this is happening because it's the cherry on the cake. I don't even know what my metaphors are anymore. But I left my friend-to-friend book that I need to read from in my office. But luckily, it looks like I have a digital copy that I can pull up really quickly on my device. So my device to the rescue. We're going to be talking about friendship and fear today, and I'll be reading from a submission that Reverend Wynn made to the Farm and Dairy many years ago, simply called Fears, and this is what he wrote. Recently, I saw a cat run up a tree when a dog came around the corner of a house. The cat showed every sign of being scared. I thought about that cat's action and realized there have been times when I felt exactly as that cat must have felt. The only difference is that I couldn't climb a tree as rapidly as a cat can. I was making a pastoral visit one afternoon while I was pastoring in Hughesville, Pennsylvania, when six or seven coon dogs came running and barking to greet me. I was halfway between the barn and the house, too far to run to either and too scared not to run. I tried to act brave and be friendly, but those dogs considered me an enemy and kept barking and snipping at me. All the time, I was working my way over to the tractor. And when I got there, I jumped up on it, and that set those dogs wild. By this time, I was up on the tractor seat, and those dogs acted like they had a prize coon up in a tree. I made up my mind I was going to stay right there until someone came, and fortunately, someone was home, came out, called the dogs off, and welcomed me into his home with apologies for those dogs. But I always thought it rather tickled him that the preacher was afraid of his dogs. Every person, we're told, has some fear or phobia. It may only be one, but even if we just have one, it is tormenting. It may be the fear of being alone, or darkness, or of mice, or heights, or some other ridiculous thing. Most people have tried ignoring their fear, but it doesn't help. A fear has the power to tie one's stomach up in knots. It makes a person want to run. Science has discovered that fears are like certain watches. They're self-winding. Running from a fear keeps the fear active. The next time a person who is afraid of something runs into that fear again, he responds with a greater urge to run, and this continues the ever-increasing problem. Scientists are also saying that if one will expose himself progressively to the objects or situations which he fears and observe closely every sensation he feels, he overcomes his fears. The ones who have followed this course say that the fear fades away and they see how foolish it was to fear what others enjoyed. This method doubtless has lots of value and truth in it. But the Bible also tells us about how to overcome fear. It teaches in many places the most basic answer to our spiritual fears, such as the fear of death, the fear of meeting God, the fear of terrible tragedy, is to know that we are right with God. The confident presence of God with us is the only guarantee for freedom from those tormenting fears. God said this to a man many, many years ago, and he will make it personal to you and to me if we will let him. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee, yea, I will help thee, yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. So we're talking about fears this morning, and so I thought this would be a good time to brush up on seeing if you guys know your fears and your phobias. So I did some research this week, and I tracked down what I think are the top 10 most common phobias, right? So they will be, every time I look up and get excited because I have a screen, and then I'm like, oh, they don't see that. So if I keep doing it, because I see it, I'm like, it's working. Oh, no, it's not working. So I'll name them, and if you think you know them, you can just shout them out. So here's the first one, triskaidekaphobia. No one knows that one? Yeah, fear of 13, right, okay. So the next one, aerophobia. fear of flying. Mysophobia is the fear of germs and contamination. Today we call this being a germaphobe. Claustrophobia, enclosed, tight spaces, right? Astrophobia. That one is actually the fear of lightning and thunder during storms. Cynophobia is the fear of dogs, which I have. So I'll give you guys permission. If you look back there and look at that screen, you can see the ferocious dog picture that I brought with me. Right? Yeah, exactly. Number four, agoraphobia. I always thought was the fear of open spaces, and that is it for some people, but it's basically the fear of being somewhere where you can't get help. And open spaces is that for a lot of people. And then there is acrophobia, which is the fear of heights, which I'm on that train. Then there's one of my favorites, ophidiophobia. Anyone know their Latin? I'm assuming it's Latin. I'm probably wrong, so don't quote me. This is where you'd see a picture of Indiana Jones. Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes? And then the number one I found is arachnophobia, which is such a common fear that it gets its own movie, right? So, to be a phobia, though, a fear, I mean, you may have heard something that kind of made you go, ooh, probably some of you, at least one. For me, it's heights, for sure. Maybe one or two others. But a phobia has to be the point where it is overwhelming and so intense that it can actually be debilitating to life itself. Reverend Wynn alluded to the fact that there are proven ways. Today we call it cognitive behavioral therapy, where you can learn to progressively expose yourself to fear and therefore overcome it. And that's all well and good, and some people benefit tremendously from that. As rare and paralyzing as phobias can be, though, there are some fears that are relatively common and universal for humans. Reverend Wynn talked about fear of tragedy, fear of being rejected by God, fear of death itself. And I love his one line. I'll probably repeat it several times this morning. He said, "In the face of all this, it is the confident presence of God with us that is the only guarantee for freedom from those kind of tormenting fears." I love that phrase, the confident presence of God. In the writing today, he referenced Isaiah 41, a couple verses, and I'm going to read now and expand on that by a few verses. If you want to follow along in a Bible that you may have brought with you, hope you didn't rely on the screen for that today, because you're out of luck. But Isaiah 41, I'll be reading verses 8 through 13. "But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, you descendants of Abraham, my friend, I took you from the ends of the earth, from the farthest corners I called you. I said, 'You are my servant, I have chosen you and have not rejected you.' So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. All who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. Those who wage war against you will be as nothing at all. For I am the Lord your God, who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, 'Do not fear, I will help you.'" So we'll get to fear in a moment, but the first thing that just jumped out at me from this passage is this really basic idea, but it's an idea that changes everything, is that you and I have the privilege and the incredible honor to identify ourselves as friends of God. How amazing is that? That the creator of heaven and earth, the sustainer of all things, looks upon you in Christ and says, "I call you friend." And we find it in other places in Scripture besides here in Isaiah 41 when it says, "descendants of my friend Abraham." Moses, when he went in to the tent of meeting, we're told that he spoke with God face to face as one speaks with a friend. And then, of course, Jesus in John 15 said to his followers, "I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business, but instead I call you friends." It's incredible. I mean, because honestly, all of us would just be happy being called a servant. We're all that prodigal son that comes home and says, listen, all I have the right to even ask for is to be a servant. And yet God wraps his arms around us and says, I call you friend, I call you son, I call you daughter. And that, my friends, if you walk away with nothing else today, walk away being reminded that you can be called a friend of God. I mean, for goodness sake, you are sitting in a friend's church. It should be easy to remember, right? Our entire history, going back several hundred years, those early Quakers called themselves friends of the truth, friends of the light, friends of Jesus. And eventually, instead of calling themselves a church or a denomination, they called themselves a society of friends. They wanted to get away from the idea that a church is a building, because it still isn't, by the way. But it's a group of people. So they said, we are a society of friends. And in talking about the friendship with God, the line that stood out to me was, I have chosen you and not rejected you. I've chosen you and not rejected you. And I read that passage, and it took me way back to high school, because it reminded me of Sadie Hawkins' dance. Anybody? Remember, anybody experienced the Sadie Hawkins? Good. A few hands going up. I see a few giggles and nods. That's fine. I'm assuming many of you are at least familiar with the concept. But did you know the history of the Sadie Hawkins dance? It actually started in a comic strip, of all places, in 1937, the idea of a Sadie Hawkins dance. But by the next year, the first one became a reality. A year later, there were hundreds of Sadie Hawkins dances and events around the country. By 1952, so what, 15 years later, an estimated 40,000 events a year were happening. Today, there are some more creative names for it. Maybe it's not called Sadie Hawkins. One of the ones I discovered in my research this week that I really enjoyed, it's called the MORP, M-O-R-P, which is prom spelled backwards. Clever. And if you're unfamiliar with the Sadie Hawkins dance, it goes like this. Typically, traditionally, a guy asks a girl to go to the dance with him, right? That's how traditionally it goes. Well, for Sadie Hawkins, or MORP, or whatever it might be, it's flipped on its head, and it's expected that the ladies approach the men and ask them to go to the dance. And I will tell you, this was one of my favorite times of the year every year when I was in high school. Because it was the one time a year when I, as the gentleman, did not have to fear rejection, right? Because there's always that fear of rejection when you ask a girl to go to a dance with you, and she may say no for one reason or another. She maybe has a boyfriend, she may be as busy, she maybe needs to wash her hair that night, something like that, right? And so for me, once a year, there was no worry about that fear of rejection, and it was so wonderful. But it also helped me to realize something that I didn't know until then, is that there's a very real fear on the other side of that equation. It's the fear of, maybe I'll never even get asked. And it's a fear that I think would have made sense in my brain, but I would have never understood until experience. And so what I love about that passage is that it says, I have chosen you and not rejected you. It covers both sides of that coin. God says, I've actively chosen you, and when you come to me, I will never reject you. Because I call you friend. And that's incredible. So this friendship with God, it is the foundation from which we start to understand what these three promises within Isaiah, the Isaiah passage we read. If we are friends with God, and we are, then these three promises about coaxing us away from fear can be understood in the context of that friendship. And the first one is this: I am with you, it said when we read it. I am with you. This is about God's presence with us. I am with you, God's presence. Again, echoes back to Reverend Wynn's comment, the confident presence of God with us. There is great security and satisfaction in knowing that we are not alone. Presence by itself, in and of itself, is a tremendous gift that we can give to one another. Simply being present as human beings. I'm a big fan of Tom Hanks, and one of my favorite Tom Hanks movies is Castaway. And if you've seen it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Not only entertaining, and I think he just gave a fantastic performance, but I love the exploration of what it means for a human being to be isolated and alone. And if you've seen the movie, you know, Wilson, right? It ends up befriending a volleyball that has a face on it. I would argue that we are designed, we are hardwired to be with people. And so therefore, presence, just being present with one another, is a gift that we can give to each other. And we see God's presence promised to us, not just here in this passage in Isaiah, but when there are passages that say things like, I will never leave you, and never will I forsake you. Or when Jesus is speaking to his followers at the end of Matthew and he's sending them out, go preach the gospel, baptize, teach people to be my disciples. And then what's the final promise? And I will be with you until the end of the age. So because of God's friendship, in order to be coaxed away from fear, we know that God's presence is with us. The second promise is, I will strengthen you. So if it's God's presence first, then it's about God's power. I will strengthen you, we read in the passage. Not only is God present, which again, presence is a gift in and of itself, God is actively present, and God is able to spiritually strengthen us through the Holy Spirit. Not only is he present, he is actively present with us. Colossians chapter 1, verse 11 says it this way, be strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience. And I read that verse this week and actually thought, wow, that doesn't have the ending I think we might expect. I mean, let me read it again, the first half, right? Be strengthened with power according to glorious might. And I think we might expect, so you can battle your enemies and stomp them into the ground. Something along those lines. Something you'd expect to hear from a high school football coach in a crowded locker room on a Friday night, right? Something like that. But how does that verse actually end? Be strengthened with power and might so that you may have great endurance and patience. Endurance and patience. My family doesn't watch a lot of TV, especially in the summer, because there's so many other things to do, but it seems like the times when we're just relaxing in the evening and it's not quite time to go to bed yet for the kids, the one thing we catch on television is American Ninja Warrior. Anybody familiar with that show? Some of you nodding heads? Okay, great. So if you're familiar with it, you know what it is. If not, it's essentially the fifth grade version of me. It's a dream come true, because it's like this adult-sized obstacle course that these really amazing athletic people try and get themselves through to get to the end and move on to the next round and whatnot. Now, if you're watching this current season, they have a new obstacle now. It's called Dangerous Curves. And I wish I could show you the picture, but I can't. It's called Dangerous Curves. Actually, you know what? I'll give you permission one more time. Turn around and look back there. So that guy is doing dangerous curves, all right? Okay, good. So the way that thing works is that you climb up a board on one side, while you grab it on the outsides, and it's a curved board that also rotates a little bit as you're trying to climb up it using, and then you get to the top of that, and you have to reach across to this other board over here, and then when you grab a hold of that, you have to use your body weight to turn that board all the way 180 degrees, and then there's another curved board over here that you have to transfer yourself to and lower yourself down. Again, it's curved, and it moves as you're trying to grasp a hold of it. Needless to say, many contestants bit the dust, well, the water, which is underneath the course, on that particular thing. But I love that picture, because all the strength that those competitors have at that point, all that strength is actually used for endurance and patience, because you get up to the top and you're ready to transfer from one thing to another. Your muscles are providing your brain the time to think things through about what needs to come next. Be strengthened so that you can endure with patience. So if we have God's presence and his power, the third promise from Isaiah that we read is, I will help you. multiple times, I will help you. This is about the preservation that God gives. His presence, his power, and his preservation. We hear an echo of the help that comes from God in passages like Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the mountains, and where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. Now, the kind of help that's being talked about in Psalm 121 and in the Isaiah passage we read, don't think about that kind of help like we think about the ways that we get help and assistance sometimes in our world, right? Like if you make reservations at a nicer restaurant, and then you end up going up to the maitre d' desk, it's not a desk, I don't know, stand, and you know, they check you and they say, let me help you find your table, right? They assist you. Or if you go into a department store and you can't find the thing that you need, you can ask for help or assistance, and that person can then help. Although that's becoming even less and less common these days, because I was at Home Depot yesterday and I knew what I needed, and not only on my phone could it tell me that it was in stock at the Salem store, and some of you have experienced this, it told me exactly the aisle and the bay number. So I just kind of drip, 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 and I followed it, and there I was, right? Or, but maybe the kind of help when your kids or your grandkids insist on helping you cook dinner or helping you make desserts. Anybody ever had that kind of help before? Right? Yeah, exactly. Not as helpful as it actually sounds. But that's not the kind of help or assistance being talked about in Psalm 121. That psalm is part of a grouping of psalms called the Psalms of Ascent. Right? And that the Jewish people, when they would journey from wherever they lived, they would journey to Jerusalem for the major festivals. And while they would journey, they would sing the songs of ascent together, that grouping of psalms. They would sing them as they were going up to Jerusalem, the songs of ascent, going to Jerusalem, right? Going up to the mountain. I have my eyes on the mountains. Where does my help come from? But what you need to understand is that journey could be very long for some of them and very dangerous. There are dangerous roads, sometimes merely narrow pathways, and there are often bandits waiting alongside the road to take all your stuff. That's why the story of the Good Samaritan, that's not some made-up tale. That, things like that happened on these roads that they would travel. And so during that song, when you're traveling with your family and you sing about my help coming from the Lord, that's not this minor assistance. That is potentially life-saving, life-changing help that comes from God. His presence, his power, and his preservation. And the last thing I noticed is in the midst of understanding our friendship with God and how that can drive out our fears, we're told about what happens with all those who rage against you. Those who rage against you. That phrase caught my attention this week. And then like a day later, I got an email for one of our ABF curriculums that literally connected right to it, that had some statistics I want to share with you guys, right? So according to recent studies, these things are true. About 84% of Americans say that they are angrier today than they were a generation ago. 84! You heard that right. 84% compared to similar studies a generation ago, people are angrier 84% of the time. And you might ask, why? What are they angry about? Well, the study asked some questions, and here's what the study found. Regarding what made them angry, 29% reported getting angry often while checking the news, and 42% they get angry sometimes while checking the news. With 31% of them, they said they get angry sometimes when checking social media, and 12% say they often got angry when checking social media. So not the entire answer, but I would argue a big answer for why we're angrier now than a generation ago, significantly angrier, 84% more angry. It's because we have access to 24/7 news and 24/7 social media, and it's making us furious. You know, we just keep gobbling it up, gobbling it up, gobbling it up, even though it continues to drive our anger through the roof. One person said in the article, there's no question that we are in angry times. It's in our politics, in our schools, and in our homes. And anger can be a destructive emotion. So what do we do when anger or rage comes against us from our enemies? We're told that the confident presence of God is with us in friendship can drive out fear. And then we learn from the Isaiah passage about what will happen to those who oppose us, who rage in opposition against us. They will be ashamed and disgraced. They will be brought to nothing, and they will disappear. But here's what I find most interesting. In that passage in Isaiah, where we're told all those things will happen to those who rage in opposition against us, what are we told to do in response to them? Nothing. But what's our default? When we are on the receiving end of raging opposition, our default is what? Oh yeah, I'll give you a taste of your own medicine. And we rage in opposition right back. But in the Isaiah passage, all those things are said to happen. We are not told that we are to engage actively in anything to make it so. This idea is repeated again and again in Scripture. Romans 12 puts it this way. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge and I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That idea of burning coals, it's not actually a violent retribution metaphor. It's about awakening the conscience of someone who is doing something unjust. I look at our world and I wonder, perhaps as Christians, our lack of a raging response is part of God's judgment upon people who rage. Because if we follow precepts like Romans 12, do not take revenge, leave room for God's wrath, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. We find a similar situation way back in Exodus chapter 14. In that passage, Moses says to the people, do not be afraid, stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. And can I remind you the context of this that's happening in here? The Jewish people, recently released from slavery, have a large body of water in front of them and the most powerful army in the world behind them. And by the way, those are the people that used to enslave them. And it's in this moment, when it seems like there is no way forward and certainly no way back, that Moses tells the people, you need to only be still, that God will fight for you. Sometimes I wonder, if we look at our world and we go, why is God not more active? Why don't we see God moving more? I wonder if it's because in the midst of raging opposition, way too often and way too quickly, we're like, I'm going to handle this. I'll take this. Because if we're not leaving space for God to do what God says he will do, then should we wonder that he is not as active as maybe we would like him to be? Are we willing to leave space for God to do his work? The last thing that I noticed studying this week is it was interesting to me that the passage talks about God's righteous right hand. And then later in the passage, it talks about how he will take each of us by our right hand. And there were really two interesting things to me about that. The first one is this. If I'm standing here and this is my right hand, and I reach out to take someone else's hand on this side of me, which hand am I actually going to be grabbing? I'll be grabbing their left hand. So for God to take our right hand and his righteous right hand, the only way that's possible is if we actually face each other. And I love that image of God taking us by our hand, face to face, and saying things like, don't be afraid. I will help you, and I will strengthen you. And the other thing about God holding our right hand. I read somebody online this week talked about, you know, reading through this passage, and she said, I stopped at that idea of God taking my right hand and tried to imagine what would it be like for God to hold my right hand. And she paused and she said, it would be terrible. I'm right-handed. I wouldn't be able to do anything. And then she paused and she went, I wouldn't be able to do anything. Are we willing to allow the righteous, upholding right hand of God to take our hand in order to direct us in the ways that he wants us to go? So a few things to think about as we close our time together, to reflect on, to pray about here with a moment of silence, and then you can take them with you this week. And they're on the bulletin insert there, these questions and more that you can take home and expand on your discipleship work during the week. The first question is this. Actually, it's not a question. It's an invitation. If nothing else today, thank God that he has called you friend, that you are chosen and not rejected. It is a beautiful and powerful thing. Secondly, which one of those three promises that we talked about today do you feel you most need reminded of in your life right now? God's presence, God's power, or maybe God's preservation? Maybe you feel like God is nowhere to be found and you need his presence revealed. Or maybe you know God is there, but you feel weak and that you need empowered. Or maybe you feel like you are strong, but that the opposition is too much and that you need persevered. And then lastly, what sorts of things tempt you into a response characterized by raging opposition? And what area of your life do you need to maybe stop shaking a fist or stop pointing a finger and instead take hold of the hand of God as he reaches out to take hold of your hand? So just take a moment or two to consider those things, to pray about them, to reflect on them. If you want to close your eyes or bow your heads, if that's helpful, then I invite you to do that. And as I silence my voice for just a moment, allow the Spirit to speak to you, and then I will close that time with a word of prayer.